12. The shadow of the pyramid's tip had come to touch the road. Now the sky in the west changed from the orange of a reaptide bonfire to that cauldron of blood Roland had seen in his dreams ever since childhood. When it did, the call of the tower doubled, then trebled. Roland felt it reach out and grasp him with invisible hands. The time of his destiny was come. Yet there was this boy, this friendless boy. Roland would not leave him to die here at the end of Endworld if he could help it. He had no interest in atonement, and yet Patrick had come to stand for all the murders and betrayals that had finally brought him to the Dark Tower. Roland's family was dead. His misbegotten son had been the last. Now would Eld and Tower be joined. First, though, or last, this. "Patrick, listen to me," he said, taking the boy's shoulder with his whole left hand and his mutilated right. "If you'd live to make all the pictures Ka has stored away in your future, ask me not a single question, nor ask me to repeat a single thing." The boy looked at him, large-eyed and silent in the red and dying light, and the song of the tower rose around them to a mighty shout that was nothing but Kamala. "Go back to the road. Pick up all the cans that are whole. That should be enough to feed you. Go back the way we came. Never leave the road. You'll do fine." Patrick nodded with perfect understanding. Roland saw he believed, and that was good. Belief would protect him even more surely than a revolver, even one with the sandalwood grips. "Go back to the Federal. Go back to the robot stuttering Bill that was. Tell him to take you to a door that swings open on America's side. If it won't open to your hand, draw it open with thy pencil. Do ye understand?" Patrick nodded again. Of course he understood. "If Ka should eventually lead you to Susanna in any where or when, tell her Roland loves her still, and with all his heart." He drew Patrick to him and kissed the boy's mouth. "Give her that. Do ye understand?" Patrick nodded. "All right. I go. Long days and pleasant nights. May we meet in the clearing at the end of the path, when all worlds end." Yet even then he knew this would not happen. For the worlds would never end, not now. And for him there would be no clearing. For Roland Duchesne of Gilead, last of Eld's line, the path ended at the Dark Tower. And that did him fine. He rose to his feet. The boy looked up at him with wide, wondering eyes, clutching his pad. Roland turned. He drew in breath to the bottom of his lungs, and let it out in a great cry. "Now comes Roland to the Dark Tower. I have been true, and I still carry the gun of my father, and you will open to my hand." Patrick watched him stride to where the road ended, a black silhouette against that bloody, burning sky. He watched as Roland walked among the roses, and sat shivering in the shadows as Roland began to cry the names of his friends and loved ones and comrades. Those names carried clear in that strange air, as if they would echo forever. "I come in the name of Stephen Duchesne, he of Gilead. I come in the name of Gabrielle Duchesne, she of Gilead. I come in the name of Cortland Andrus, he of Gilead. I come in the name of Cuthbert Allgood, he of Gilead. I come in the name of Alan Johns, he of Gilead. I come in the name of Jamie Ducurry, he of Gilead. I come in the name of Vanney the Wise, he of Gilead. I come in the name of Hax the Cook, he of Gilead. I come in the name of David the Hawk, he of Gilead in the sky. I come in the name of Susan Delgado, she of Magus. I come in the name of Shimi Ruiz, he of Magus. I come in the name of Per Callahan, he of Jerusalem's Lot and the Rhodes. I come in the name of Ted Brodigan, he of America. I come in the name of Dinky Earnshaw, he of America. I come in the name of Aunt Talitha, she of River Crossing, and will lay her cross here as I was bid. I come in the name of Stephen King, he of Maine. I come in the name of Oi, the Brave, he of Midworld. I come in the name of Eddie Dean, he of New York. I come in the name of Susanna Dean, she of New York. I come in the name of Jake Chambers, he of New York, whom I call my own true son. I am Roland of Gilead, and I come as myself. You will open to me. After that came the sound of a horn. It simultaneously chilled Patrick's blood and exalted him. The echoes faded into silence. Then, perhaps a minute later, came a great, echoing boom, the sound of a door swinging shut forever. And after that came silence. 13. Patrick sat where he was at the base of the pyramid, shivering, until Old Star and Old Mother rose in the sky. The song of the roses and the tower hadn't ceased, but it had grown low and sleepy, little more than a murmur. At last he went back to the road, gathered as many whole cans as he could. There was a surprising number of them, considering the force of the explosion that had demolished the cart, and found a deerskin sack that would hold them. He realized he had forgotten his pencil, and went back to get it. Beside the pencil, gleaming in the starlight, was Roland's watch. The boy took it with a small and nervous hoot of glee. He put it in his pocket. Then he went back to the road and slung his little sack of gunna over his shoulder. I can tell you that he walked until nearly midnight, and that he looked at the watch before taking his rest. I can tell you that the watch had stopped completely. I can tell you that come noon of the following day, he looked at it again and saw that it had begun to run in the correct direction once more, albeit very slowly. But of Patrick, I can tell you no more. Not whether he made it back to the Federal, not whether he found Stuttering Bill that was, not whether he eventually came once more to America's side. I can tell you none of these things, say sorry. Here, the darkness hides him from my storyteller's eye, and he must go on alone. Susanna in New York. Epilogue. No one takes alarm as the little electric cart slides out of nowhere an inch at a time until it's wholly here in Central Park. No one sees it but us. Most of those here are looking skyward as the first snowflakes of what will prove to be a great pre-Christmas snowstorm come skirling down from a white sky. The blizzard of 87, the newspapers will call it. Visitors to the park who aren't watching the snowfall begin are watching the carolers, who are from public schools far uptown. They are wearing either dark red blazers, the boys, or dark red jumpers, the girls. This is the Harlem School Choir, sometimes called the Harlem Roses in the Post and its rival tabloid, the New York Sun. They sing an old hymn in gorgeous doo-wop harmony, snapping their fingers as they make their way through the staves, turning it into something that sounds almost like early spurs, coasters, or dark diamonds. They are standing not too far from the environment where the polar bears live their city lives. And the song they're singing is, "What Child Is This?" One of those looking up into the snow is a man Susanna knows well, and her heart leaps straight up to heaven at the sight of him. In his left hand, he's holding a large paper cup, and she's sure it contains hot chocolate. The good kind, Mitschlag. For a moment, she's unable to touch the controls of the little cart, which came from another world. Thoughts of Roland and Patrick have left her mind. All she can think of is Eddie. Eddie in front of her right here and now. Eddie alive again. And if this is not the Keystone World, not quite, what of that? If Co-op City is in Brooklyn or even in Queens, and Eddie drives a Takuro Spirit instead of a Buick Electra, what of those things? It doesn't matter. Only one thing would. And it's that which keeps her hand from rising to the throttle and trundling the cart toward him. What if he doesn't recognize her? What if when he turns, he sees nothing but a homeless black lady in an electric cart whose battery will soon be as flat as a sat-on hat? A black lady with no money, no clothes, no address, not in this where and when, say thank ye sigh, and no legs. A homeless black lady with no connection to him. Or what if he does know her? Somewhere far back in his mind, yet still denies her as completely as Peter denied Jesus, because remembering is just too hurtful. Worse still, what if he turns to her, and she sees the burned-out, fucked-up, empty-eyed stare of the longtime junkie? What if, and here comes the snow that will soon turn the whole world white? "Stop thy grizzling and go to him," Roland tells her. "You didn't face Blaine and the Taheen of Blue Heaven and the thing under Castle Discordia just to turn tail and run now, did you? Surely you've got a moit more guts than that." But she isn't sure she really does, until she sees her hand rise to the throttle. Before she can twist it, however, the gunslinger's voice speaks to her again, this time sounding wearily amused. "Perhaps there's something you want to get rid of first, Susanna?" She looks down and sees Roland's weapon stuck through her crossbelt like a Mexican bandido's pistola or a pirate's cutlass. She pulls it free, amazed at how good it feels in her hand, how brutally right. Parting from this, she thinks, will be like parting from a lover. And she doesn't have to, does she? The question is, what does she love more, the man or the gun? All other choices will flow from this one. On impulse, she rolls the cylinder and sees that the rounds inside look old, their casings dull. "These'll never fire," she thinks. And, without knowing why, or precisely what it means, "these are wets." She sights up the barrel and is queerly saddened, but not surprised, to find that the barrel lets through no light. It's plugged. Has been for decades, from the look of it. This gun will never fire again. There is no choice to be made after all. This gun is over. Susanna, still holding the revolver with the sandalwood grips in one hand, twists the throttle with the other. The little electric cart, the one she named Hofat 3, although that is already fading in her mind, rolls soundlessly forward. It passes a green trash barrel with "Keep Litter in Its Place" stenciled on the side. She tosses Roland's revolver into this litter barrel. Doing it hurts her heart, but she never hesitates. It's heavy and sinks into the crumpled fast food wrappers, advertising circulars, and discarded newspapers like a stone into water. She is still enough of a gunslinger to bitterly regret throwing away such a storied weapon, even if the final trip between worlds has spoiled it. But she's already become enough of the woman who's waiting for her up ahead not to pause or look back once the job is done. Before she can reach the man with the paper cup, he turns. He is indeed wearing a sweatshirt that says, "I drink Nozzola." But she barely registers that. It's him, that's what she registers. It's Edward Cantor Dean. And then even that becomes secondary, because what she sees in his eyes is all she has feared. It's total puzzlement. He doesn't know her. Then, tentatively, he smiles, and it is the smile she remembers, the one she always loved. Also, he's clean, she knows it at once. She sees it in his face, mostly in his eyes. The carolers from Harlem sing, and he holds out the cup of hot chocolate. "Thank God," he says. "I just about decided I'd have to drink this myself. That the voices were wrong and I was going crazy after all. That, well..." He trails off. Looking more than puzzled, he looks afraid. "Listen, you are here for me, aren't you? Please tell me I'm not making an utter ass of myself, because, lady, right now, I feel as nervous as a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs."
"You're not," she says. "Making an ass of yourself, I mean."
She's remembering Jake's story about the voices he heard arguing in his mind, one yelling that he was dead, the other that he was alive. Both of them utterly convinced. She has at least some idea of how terrible that must be, because she knows a little about other voices. Strange voices.
"Thank God," he says. "Your name is Susanna?"
"Yes," she says. "My name is Susanna."
Her throat is terribly dry, but the words come out at least. She takes the cup from him and sips the hot chocolate through the cream. It is sweet and good, a taste of this world. The sound of the honking cabs, their drivers hurrying to make their day before the snow shuts them down, is equally good. Grinning, he reaches out and wipes a tiny dab of the cream from the tip of her nose. His touch is electric, and she sees that he feels it too. It occurs to her that he is going to kiss her again for the first time, and sleep with her again for the first time, and fall in love with her again for the first time. He may know those things because voices have told him, but she knows them for a far better reason, because those things have already happened. "Ka is a wheel," Roland said, "and now she knows it's true. Her memories of Midworld, the gunslingers where and when, are growing hazy. But she thinks she will remember just enough to know it's all happened before. And there is something incredibly sad about this. But at the same time, it's good. It's a damn miracle, is what it is." "Are you cold?" he asks.
"No, I'm okay."
"Why?"
"You shivered."
"It's the sweetness of the cream." Then, looking at him as she does it, she pokes her tongue out and licks a bit of the nutmeg-dusted foam. "If you aren't cold now, you will be," he says. "WRKO says the temperature's going to drop 20 degrees tonight. So I bought you something." From his back pocket, he takes a knitted cap, the kind you can pull down over your ears. She looks at the front of it and sees the words there printed in red. "Merry Christmas." "Bought it in Brendio's on Fifth Avenue," he says. Susanna has never heard of Brendio's. Brentano's, maybe. The bookstore, but not Brendio's. But of course, in the America where she grew up, she never heard of Nozzola or Takuro Spirit Automobiles either.
"Did your voices tell you to buy it?"
Teasing him a little now, he blushes. "Actually, you know, they sort of did. Try it on." "It's a perfect fit."
"Tell me something," she says. "Who's the president?"
"You're not going to tell me it's Ronald Reagan, are you?" He looks at her incredulously for a moment and then smiles.
"What? That old actor who used to host Death Valley Days on TV? You're kidding, right?"
"Nope. I always thought you were the one who was kidding about Ronnie Reagan, Eddie."
"I don't know what you mean."
"That's okay. Just tell me who the president is."
"Gary Hart,"
he says, as if speaking to a child. "From Colorado. He almost dropped out of the race in 1980, as I'm sure you know, over that monkey business. Then he said, 'Fuck 'em if they can't take a joke,' and hung on in there. Ended up winning in a landslide." His smile fades a little as he studies her.
"You're not kidding me, are you?"
"Are you kidding me about the voices? The ones you hear in our head? The ones that wake you up at 2 in the morning? Eddie looks almost shocked.
"How can you know that?"
"It's a long story. Maybe someday I'll tell you. If I can still remember," she thinks. "It's not just the voices."
"No?"
"No, I've been dreaming of you. For months now. I've been waiting for you. Listen, we don't know each other. This is crazy, but do you have a place to stay? You don't, do you?" She shakes her head, doing a passable John Wayne. Or maybe it's Blaine the Train she's imitating. She says, "I'm a stranger here in Dodge, Pilgrim." Her heart is pounding slowly and heavily in her chest, but she feels a rising joy. This is going to be all right. She doesn't know how it can be. But yes, it's going to be just fine. This time Ka is working in her favor, and the force of Ka is enormous. This she knows from experience. "If I asked how I know you, or where you come from..." He pauses, looking at her levelly, and then says the rest of it. "Or how I can possibly love you already," she smiles. It feels good to smile, and it no longer hurts the side of her face. Because whatever was there, some sort of scar maybe she can't quite remember, is gone.
"Sugar," she tells him, "it's what I said, a long story. You'll get some of it in time, though, what I remember of it. And it could be that we still have some work to do for an outfit called the Tet Corporation."
She looks around and then says, "What year is this?"
1987,
he says.
"And do you live in Brooklyn? Or maybe the Bronx?"
The young man whose dreams and squabbling voices have led him here with a cup of hot chocolate in his hand and a Merry Christmas hat in his back pocket, bursts out laughing. God, no, I'm from White Plains. I came in on the train with my brother. He's right over there. He wanted a closer look at the polar bears.
The brother. Henry. The great sage and eminent junkie. Her heart sinks.
Let me introduce you, he says.
No, really,
Hey, if we're going to be friends, you got to be friends with my kid brother. We're tight. Jake. Hey, Jake. She hasn't noticed the boy standing down by the railing, which guards the sunken polar bear's environment from the rest of the park. But now he turns, and her heart takes a great, giddy leap in her chest. Jake waves and ambles toward them.
Jake's been dreaming about you, too, Eddie tells her. It's the only reason I know I'm not going crazy. Any crazier than usual, at least.
She takes Eddie's hand, that familiar, well-loved hand, and when the fingers close over hers, she thinks she will die of joy. She will have many questions, so will they, but for the time being, she has only one that feels important. As the snow begins to fall more thickly around them, landing in his hair and in his lashes and on the shoulders of his sweatshirt, she asks it.
You and Jake, what's your last name?
Torin, he says. It's German. Before either of them can say anything else, Jake joins them. And will I tell you that these three lived happily ever after? I will not. For no one ever does, but there was happiness, and they did live. Beneath the flowing and sometimes glimpsed glamour of the beam that connects Shardik the bear and Maturin the turtle by way of the Dark Tower, they did live. That's all. That's enough. Say thank you.
Found. Coda. 1. I've told my tale all the way to the end, and am satisfied. It was, I set my watch and warrant on it, the kind only a good god would save for last, full of monsters and marvels and voyaging here and there. I can stop now, put my pen down and rest my weary hand, although perhaps not forever. The hand that tells the tales has a mind of its own and a way of growing restless. I can close my eyes to Midworld and all that lies beyond Midworld. Yet some of you who have provided the ears, without which no tale can survive a single day, are likely not so willing. You are the grim, goal-oriented ones who will not believe that the joy is in the journey rather than the destination, no matter how many times it has been proven to you. You are the unfortunate ones who still get the lovemaking all confused with the paltry squirt that comes to end the lovemaking. The orgasm is, after all, God's way of telling us we've finished, at least for the time being, and should go to sleep. You are the cruel ones who deny the gray havens, where tired characters go to rest. You say you want to know how it all comes out. You say you want to follow Roland into the tower. You say that is what you paid your money for. The show you came to see. I hope most of you know better, want better. I hope you came to hear the tale, and not just munch your way through the pages to the ending. For an ending, you only have to turn to the last page and see what is there writ upon. But endings are heartless. An ending is a closed door no man or many can open. I've written many, but most only for the same reason that I pull on my pants in the morning before leaving the bedroom. Because it is the custom of the country. And so, I tell you this. You can stop here. You can let your last memory be of seeing Eddie, Susanna, and Jake in Central Park. Together again for the first time. Listening to the children's choir sing What Child Is This? You can be content in the knowledge that sooner or later, Oi, probably a canine version with a long neck, odd gold-ringed eyes, and a bark that sometimes sounds eerily like speech, will also enter the picture. That's a pretty picture, isn't it? I think so. And pretty close to happily ever after, too. Close enough for government work, as Eddie would say.
Should you go on, you will surely be disappointed, perhaps even heartbroken. I have one key left on my belt, but all that opens is that final door, the one marked Unfound. What's behind it won't improve your love life. Grow hair on your bald spot or add 5 years to your natural span, not even 5 minutes. There is no such thing as a happy ending. I never met a single one to equal Once Upon a Time. Endings are heartless. Ending is just another word for goodbye. 2. Would you still? Very well, then. Come. Do you hear me sigh? Here is the dark tower at the end of Endworld. See it, I beg. See it very well. Here is the dark tower at sunset. 3. He came to it with the oddest feeling of remembrance, what Susanna and Eddie called déjà vu. The roses of Can Can O'Ray opened before him in a path to the dark tower, the yellow suns deep in their cups seeming to regard him like eyes. And as he walked toward that gray-black column, Roland felt himself begin to slip from the world as he had always known it. He called the names of his friends and loved ones, as he had always promised himself he would. Called them in the gloaming, and with perfect force, for no longer was there any need to reserve energy with which to fight the tower's pull. To give in, finally, was the greatest relief of his life. He called the names of his compadres and amoras, and although each came from deeper in his heart, each seemed to have less business with the rest of him. His voice rolled away to the darkening red horizon, name upon name. He called Eddie's and Susanna's, he called Jake's, and last of all he called his own. When the sound of it had died out, the blast of a great horn replied, not from the tower itself, but from the roses that lay in a carpet all around it. That horn was the voice of the roses, and cried him welcome with a kingly blast. In my dreams, the horn was always mine, he thought. I should have known better, for mine was lost with Cuthbert at Jericho Hill. A voice whispered from above him. It would have been the work of 3 seconds to bend and pick it up. Even in the smoke and the death, 3 seconds. Time, Roland. It always comes back to that. That was, he thought, the voice of the beam, the one they had saved. If it spoke out of gratitude, it could have saved its breath, for what good were such words to him now? He remembered a line from Browning's poem. One taste of the old times sets all to rights. Such had never been his experience. In his own, memories brought only sadness. They were the food of poets and fools, sweets that left a bitter aftertaste in the mouth and throat. Roland stopped for a moment, still 10 paces from the ghostwood door in the tower's base, letting the voice of the roses, that welcoming horn, echo away to nothing. The feeling of déjà vu was still strong, almost as though he had been here after all. And of course he had been, in 10,000 premonitory dreams. He looked up at the balcony where the Crimson King had stood, trying to defy Ka and bar his way. There, about 6 feet above the cartons that held the few remaining sneeches, the old lunatic had had no other weapons after all, it seemed, he saw 2 red eyes, floating in the darkening air, looking down at him with eternal hatred. From their backs, the thin silver of the optic nerves, now tinted red-orange with the light of the leaving sun, trailed away to nothing. The gunslinger supposed the Crimson King's eyes would remain up there forever, watching Can Can O'Ray while their owner wandered the world to which Patrick's eraser and enchanted artist's eye had sent him. Or, more likely, to the space between the worlds. Roland walked on to where the path ended at the steel-banded slab of black ghostwood. Upon it, a sigil that he now knew well was engraved 3/4 of the way up. Unfound. Here he laid 2 things, the last of his gunna, Aunt Talitha's cross and his remaining 6-gun. When he stood up, he saw the first two hieroglyphics had faded away.
Found. Unfound had become found.
He raised his hand as if to knock, but the door swung open of its own accord before he could touch it, revealing the bottom steps of an ascending spiral stairway. There was a sighing voice, "Welcome, Roland, thee of Eld." It was the tower's voice. This edifice was not stone at all, although it might look like stone. This was a living thing. Gan himself, likely. And the pulse he'd felt deep in his head, even thousands of miles from here, had always been Gan's beating life force.
"Kamala, gunslinger. Kamala, come, come."
And wafting out came the smell of alkali, bitter as tears. The smell of what? What exactly? Before he could place it, the odor was gone, leaving Roland to surmise he had imagined it. He stepped inside, and the song of the tower, which he had always heard, even in Gilead, where it had hidden in his mother's voice as she sang him her cradle songs, finally ceased. There was another sigh. The door swung shut with a boom, but he was not left in blackness. The light that remained was that of the shining spiral windows mixed with the glow of sunset. Stone stairs, a passage just wide enough for one person, ascended.
"Now comes Roland," he called,
and the words seemed to spiral up into infinity.
"Thee at the top, hear and make me welcome if you would. If you're my enemy, know that I come unarmed and mean no ill."
He began to climb. 19 steps brought him to the first landing, and to each one thereafter. A door stood open here, and beyond it was a small round room. The stones of its wall were carved with thousands of overlapping faces. Many he knew. One was the face of Calvin Tower, peeping slyly over the top of an open book. The faces looked at him, and he heard their murmuring. "Welcome, Roland, you of the many miles and many worlds. Welcome, thee of Gilead, thee of Eld." On the far side of the room was a door flanked by dark red swags traced with gold. About 6 feet up from the door, at the exact height of his eyes, was a small round window, little bigger than an outlaw's peek-hole. There was a sweet smell, and this one he could identify. The bag of pine sachet his mother had placed first in his cradle, then, later, in his first real bed. It brought back those days with great clarity, as aromas always do. If any sense serves us as a time machine, it's that of smell. Then, like the bitter call of the alkali, it was gone. The room was unfurnished, but a single item lay on the floor. He advanced to it and picked it up. It was a small cedar clip, its bow wrapped in a bit of blue silk ribbon. He had seen such things long ago in Gilead, must once have worn one himself. When the sawbones cut a newly arrived baby's umbilical cord, separating mother from child, such a clip was put on above the baby's navel, where it would stay until the remainder of the cord fell off, and the clip with it. The navel itself was called Tetka Kan Gan. The bit of silk on this one told that it had belonged to a boy. A girl's clip would have been wrapped with pink ribbon.
"'Twas my own," he thought.
He regarded it a moment longer, fascinated, then put it carefully back where it had been, where it belonged. When he stood up again, he saw a baby's face.
"Can this be my darling Babo? If you say so, let it be so."
Among the multitude of others, it was contorted, as if its first breath of air outside the womb had not been to its liking, already fouled with death. Soon, it would pronounce judgment on its new situation with a squall that would echo throughout the apartments of Stephen and Gabrielle, causing those friends and servants who heard it to smile with relief. Only Martin Broadcloak would scowl. The birthing was done, and it had been a live birth, tell Gan and all the gods thank you. There was an heir to the line of Eld, and thus there was still the barest outside chance that the world's rueful shuffle toward ruin might be reversed. Roland left that room, his sense of déjà vu stronger than ever. So was the sense that he had entered the body of Gan himself. He turned to the stairs and once more began to climb. 4. Another 19 steps took him to the second landing and the second room. Here bits of cloth were scattered across the circular floor. Roland had no question that they had once been an infant's clout, torn to shreds by a certain petulant interloper who had then gone out onto the balcony for a look back at the field of roses and found himself betaken. He was a creature of monumental slyness, full of evil wisdom. But in the end he had slipped, and now he would pay for ever and ever. If it was only a look he wanted, why did he bring his ammunition with him when he stepped out? Because it was his only gunna, and slung over his back, whispered one of the faces carved into the curve of the wall. This was the face of Mordred. Roland saw no hatefulness there now, but only the lonely sadness of an abandoned child. That face was as lonesome as a train whistle on a moonless night. There had been no clip for Mordred's navel when he came into the world, only the mother he had taken for his first meal. No clip, never in life, for Mordred had never been part of Gan's tet. No, not he. "My red father would never go unarmed," whispered the stone boy. "Not once he was away from his castle. He was mad, but never that mad." In this room was the smell of talc put on by his mother while he lay naked on a towel, fresh from his bath, and playing with his newly discovered toes. She had soothed his skin with it, singing as she caressed him, "Baby Bunting, baby dear, baby bring your basket here." This smell, too, was gone as quickly as it had come. Roland crossed to the little window, walking among the shredded bits of diaper, and looked out. The disembodied eyes sensed him and rolled over giddily to regard him. That gaze was poisonous with fury and loss. "Come out, Roland. Come out and face me one to one, man to man, an eye for an eye, may it do ya." "I think not," Roland said, "for I have more work to do, a little more even yet." It was his last word to the Crimson King, although the lunatic screamed thoughts after him. He screamed in vain, for Roland never looked back. He had more stairs to climb and more rooms to investigate on his way to the top. 5. On the third landing he looked through the door and saw a corduroy dress that had no doubt been his when he'd been only a year old. Among the faces on this wall he saw that of his father, but as a much younger man. Later on that face had become cruel. Events and responsibilities had turned it so. But not here. Here, Stephen Deschain's eyes were those of a man looking on something that pleases him more than anything else ever has, or ever could. Here Roland smelled a sweet and husky aroma he knew for the scent of his father's shaving soap. A phantom voice whispered, "Look, Gabby, look you, he's smiling, smiling at me, and he's got a new tooth." On the floor of the fourth room was the collar of his first dog, Ringolivio. Ringo, for short. He died when Roland was 3, which was something of a gift. A boy of 3 was still allowed to weep for a lost pet, even a boy with the blood of Eld in his veins. Here the gunslinger that was smelled an odor that was wonderful but had no name, and knew it for the smell of the full earth sun in Ringo's fur. Perhaps 24 floors above Ringo's room was a scattering of breadcrumbs and a limp bundle of feathers that had once belonged to a hawk named David. No pet, he, but certainly a friend. The first of Roland's many sacrifices to the Dark Tower. On one section of the wall, Roland saw David carved in flight, his stubby wings spread above all the gathered court of Gilead, Martin the Enchanter not least among them. And to the left of the door leading onto the balcony, David was carved again. Here, his wings were folded as he fell upon court like a blind bullet, heedless of court's upraised stick. Old times. Old times and old crimes. Not far from court was the laughing face of the whore with whom the boy had sported that night. The smell in David's room was her perfume, cheap and sweet. As the gunslinger drew it in, he remembered touching the whore's pubic curls, and was shocked to remember now what he had remembered then, as his fingers slid toward her slicky sweet cleft. Being fresh out of his baby's bath, with his mother's hands upon him. He began to grow hard, and Roland fled that room in fear. 6. There was no more red to light his way now, only the eldritch blue glow of the windows, glass eyes that were alive, glass eyes that looked upon the gunless intruder. Outside the dark tower, the roses of Can Can No Re had closed for another day. Part of his mind marveled that he should be here at all, that he had one by one surmounted the obstacles placed in his path, as dreadfully single-minded as ever. "I'm like one of the old people's robots," he thought, "one that will either accomplish the task for which it has been made, or beat itself to death trying." Another part of him was not surprised at all, however. This was the part that dreamed as the beams themselves must, and this darker self thought again of the horn that had fallen from Cuthbert's fingers. Cuthbert, who had gone to his death laughing. The horn that might to this very day lie where it had fallen on the rocky slope of Jericho Hill. "And of course I've seen these rooms before. They're telling my life, after all." Indeed they were. Floor by floor and tale by tale, not to mention death by death, the rising rooms of the Dark Tower recounted Roland Deschain's life and quest. Each held its memento, each its signature aroma. Many times there was more than a single floor devoted to a single year, but there was always at least one. And after the 38th room, which is 19 doubled, do you not see it, he wished to look no more. This one contained the charred stake to which Susan Delgado had been bound. He did not enter, but looked at the face upon the wall. That much he owed her. "Roland, I love thee," Susan Delgado had screamed. And he knew it was the truth, for it was only her love that rendered her recognizable. And, love or no love, in the end she had still burned. "This is a place of death," he thought, "and not just here. All these rooms, every floor." "Yes, gunslinger," whispered the voice of the tower, "but only because your life has made it so." After the 38th floor, Roland climbed faster. 7. Standing outside, Roland had judged the tower to be roughly 600 feet high, but as he peered into the 100th room, and then the 200th, he felt sure he must have climbed 8 times 600. Soon, he would be closing in on the mark of distance his friends from America's side had called a mile. That was more floors than there could possibly be. No tower could be a mile high. But still he climbed, climbed until he was nearly running, yet never did he tire. It once crossed his mind that he'd never reach the top, that the dark tower was infinite in height as it was eternal in time. But after a moment's consideration, he rejected the idea, for it was his life the tower was telling, and while that life had been long, it had by no means been eternal. And as it had had a beginning, marked by the cedar clip and the bit of blue silk ribbon, so it would have an ending. Soon now, quite likely. The light he sensed behind his eyes was brighter now, and did not seem so blue. He passed a room containing Zoltan, the bird from the weed-eater's hut. He passed a room containing the atomic pump from the way station. He climbed more stairs, paused outside a room containing a dead lobstrosity, and by now the light he sensed was much brighter and no longer blue. It was sunlight. Past twilight it might be, with old star and old mother shining from above the dark tower, but Roland was quite sure he was seeing, or sensing, sunlight. He climbed on, without looking into any more of the rooms, without bothering to smell their aromas of the past. The stairwell narrowed until his shoulders nearly touched its curved stone sides. No songs now, unless the wind was a song, for he heard it soughing. he passed one final open door. Lying on the floor of the tiny room beyond it was a pad from which the face had been erased. All that remained were two red eyes glaring up. I have reached the present. I have reached now. Yes, and there was sunlight, Kamala sunlight, inside his eyes and waiting for him. It was hot and harsh upon his skin. The sound of the wind was louder, and that sound was also harsh. Unforgiving. Roland looked at the stairs curving upward. Now his shoulders would touch the walls, for the passage was no wider than the sides of a coffin. 19 more stairs, and then the room at the top of the dark tower would be his. I come, he called. If you hear me well, I come. He took the stairs one by one, walking with his back straight and his head held up. The other rooms had been opened to his eye, the final one was closed off, his way blocked by a ghostwood door with a single word carved upon it. That word was Roland. He grasped the knob. It was engraved with a wild rose wound around a revolver, one of those great old guns from his father, and now lost forever.
Yet it will be yours again,
whispered the voice of the tower, and the voice of the roses. These voices were now one. What do you mean? To this there was no answer. But the knob turned beneath his hand, and perhaps that was an answer. Roland opened the door at the top of the dark tower. He saw and understood at once. The knowledge falling upon him in a hammer blow, hot as the sun of the desert that was the apotheosis of all deserts. How many times had he climbed these stairs, only to find himself peeled back, curved back, turned back? Not to the beginning, when things might have been changed and time's curse lifted, but to that moment in the Mohane Desert when he had finally understood that his thoughtless, questionless quest would ultimately succeed. How many times had he traveled a loop like the one in the clip that had once pinched off his navel, his own Tetka Kangan? How many times would he travel it? Oh, no, he screamed. Please, not again. Have pity. Have mercy. The hands pulled him forward regardless. The hands of the tower knew no mercy. They were the hands of Gan, the hands of Ka, and they knew no mercy. He smelled alkali, bitter as tears. The desert beyond the door was white, blinding, waterless, without feature save for the faint, cloudy haze of the mountains which sketched themselves on the horizon. The smell beneath the alkali was that of the devil grass which brought sweet dreams, nightmares, death. But not for you, gunslinger. Never for you. You darkle. You tinked. May I be brutally frank? You go on. And each time, you forget the last time. For you, each time is the first time. He made one final effort to draw back. Hopeless. Ka was stronger. Roland of Gilead walked through the last door. The one he always sought, the one he always found. It closed gently behind him. 8. The gunslinger paused for a moment, swaying on his feet. He thought he'd almost passed out. It was the heat, of course, the damned heat. There was a wind, but it was dry and brought no relief. He took his water skin, judged how much was left by the heft of it, knew he shouldn't drink, it wasn't time to drink, and had a swallow anyway. For a moment, he had felt he was somewhere else, in the tower itself, mayhap. But of course the desert was tricky and full of mirages. The dark tower still lay thousands of wheels ahead. That sense of having climbed many stairs and looked into many rooms where many faces had looked back at him was already fading. I will reach it, he thought, squinting up at the pitiless sun. I swear on the name of my father that I will. And perhaps this time, if you get there, it will be different, a voice whispered. Surely the voice of desert delirium, for what other time had there ever been? He was what he was and where he was, just that. No more than that. no more. He had no sense of humor and little imagination, but he was steadfast. He was a gunslinger. And in his heart, well hidden, he still felt the bitter romance of the quest. "You're the one who never changes," Cort had told him once. And in his voice, Roland could have sworn he heard fear, although why Cort should have been afraid of him, a boy, Roland couldn't tell. "It'll be your damnation, boy. You'll wear out 100 pairs of boots on your walk to hell." And Vanny, "Those who do not learn from the past are condemned to repeat it." And his mother,
"Roland, must you always be so serious? Can you never rest?"
Yet the voice whispered it again. "Different this time, mayhap different." And Roland did seem to smell something other than alkali and devil grass. He thought it might be flowers. He thought it might be roses. He shifted his gunner from one shoulder to the other, then touched the horn that rode on his belt behind the gun on his right hip. The ancient brass horn had once been blown by Arthur Eld himself, or so the story did say. Roland had given it to Cuthbert Allgood at Jericho Hill, and when Cuthbert fell, Roland had paused just long enough to pick it up again, knocking the death dust of that place from its throat.
"This is your sigil,"
whispered the fading voice that bore with it the dusk-sweet scent of roses, the scent of home on a summer evening. "Oh, lost! A stone, a rose, an unfound door. A stone, a rose, a door.
This is your promise, that things may be different, Roland, that there may yet be rest, even salvation."
A pause, and then,
"If you stand, if you are true."
He shook his head to clear it, thought of taking another sip of water, and dismissed the idea. Tonight, when he built his campfire over the bones of Walter's fire, then he would drink. As for now, he would resume his journey. Somewhere ahead was the Dark Tower. Closer, however, much closer, was the man. Was he a man? Was he really? Who could perhaps tell him how to get there? Roland would catch him, and when he did, that man would talk. Ah, yes, Yar, tell it on the mountain as you'd hear it in the valley. Walter would be caught, and Walter would talk. Roland touched the horn again, and its reality was oddly comforting, as if he had never touched it before. Time to get moving. The man in black fled across the desert, and the gunslinger followed. June 19th, 1970, to April 7th, 2004. I tell God thank you. Appendix. Robert Browning. Child Roland, to the Dark Tower came. 1. My first thought was, he lied in every word, that hoary cripple, with malicious eye askance to watch the workings of his lie on mine, and mouth scarce able to afford suppression of the glee that pursed and scored its edge, had one more victim gained thereby. 2. What else should he be set for with his staff? What, save to waylay with his lies, ensnare all travellers who might find him posted there, and ask the road? I guessed what skull-like laugh would break, what crutch gin write my epitaph for pastime in the dusty thoroughfare. 3. If at his counsel I should turn aside into that ominous tract which, all agree, hides the Dark Tower, yet acquiescingly I did turn as he pointed, neither pride, now hope rekindling at the end descried, so much as gladness that some end might be. 4. For what with my whole world-wide wandering, What with my search drawn out through years, my hope dwindled into a ghost not fit to cope with that obstreperous joy success would bring, I hardly tried now to rebuke the spring my heart made, finding failure in its scope. 5. As when a sick man, very near to death, seems dead indeed, and feels begin and end the tears and takes the farewell of each friend, and hears one bid the other go, draw breath freelier outside. Since all is o'er, he saith, and the blow fallen, no grieving can amend. 6. When some discuss if near the other graves be room enough for this, and when a day suits best for carrying the corpse away, with care about the banners, scarves, and staves, and still the man hears all, and only craves he may not shame such tender love, and stay. 7. Thus I had so long suffered in this quest, heard failure prophesied so oft, been writ so many times among the band, to wit the knights who to the dark tower's search addressed their steps, that just to fail as they seemed best, and all the doubt was now, should I be fit? 8. So, quiet as despair, I turned from him, that hateful cripple, out of his highway, into the path he pointed. All the day had been a dreary one at best, and dim was settling to its close, yet shot one grim red leer to see the plain catch its estray. 9. For mark, no sooner was I fairly found pledged to the plain after a pace or two, than, pausing to throw backwards a last view o'er the safe road, 'twas gone. Grey plain all round, nothing but plain to the horizon's bound. I might go on, nought else remained to do. 10. So on I went. I think I never saw such starved, ignoble nature. Nothing throve. For flowers, as well expect a cedar grove. But cockle, spurge, according to their law, might propagate their kind with none to awe. You'd think a burr had been a treasure trove. 11. No. Penury, inertness, and grimace, in some strange sort, were the land's portion. See, or shut your eyes, said nature peevishly, it nothing skills. I cannot help my case. 'Tis the last judgment's fire must cure this place, calcine its clods, and set my prisoners free. 12. If there pushed any ragged thistle stalk above its mates, the head was chopped, the bents were jealous else. What made those holes and rents in the dock's harsh, swarth leaves, bruised as to balk all hope of greenness? 'Tis a brute must walk, passing their life out with a brute's intents. 13. As for the grass, it grew as scant as hair in leprosy. Thin, dry blades pricked the mud, which underneath looked kneaded up with blood. One stiff, blind horse, his every bone a stare, stood stupefied, however he came there, thrust out past service from the devil's stud. 14. Alive? He might be dead for aught I know, with that red gaunt and colloped neck astrain, and shut eyes underneath the rusty mane. Seldom went such grotesqueness with such woe. I never saw a brute I hated so. He must be wicked to deserve such pain. 15. I shut my eyes, and turned them on my heart, as a man calls for wine before he fights. I asked one draught of earlier, happier sights, ere fitly I could hope to play my part. Think first, fight afterwards, the soldier's art. One taste of the old time sets all to rights. 16. Not it. I fancied Cuthbert's reddening face beneath its garniture of curly gold. Dear fellow, till I almost felt him fold an arm to mine to fix me to the place, the way he used. Alas, one night's disgrace. Out went my heart's new fire, and left it cold. 17. Giles, then, the soul of honour, there he stands, frank as 10 years ago when knighted first. What honest man should dare, he said, he durst. Good, but the scene shifts. Faw! What hangman hands pinned to his breast a parchment? His own bands read it. Poor traitor, spit upon and cursed. 18. Better this present than a past like that. Back, therefore, to my darkening path again. No sound, no sight as far as I could strain. Will the night send a howlet or a bat? I asked, when something on the dismal flat came to arrest my thoughts and change their train. 19. A sudden little river crossed my path, as unexpected as a serpent comes. No sluggish tide congenial to the glooms. This, as it frothed by, might have been a bath for the fiend's glowing hoof to see the wrath of its black eddy bespate with flakes and spumes. 20. So petty, yet so spiteful, all along, low scrubby alders kneeled down over it. Drenched willows flung them headlong in a fit of mute despair, a suicidal throng. The river, which had done them all the wrong, whate'er that was, rolled by, deterred no whit. 21. Which, while I forded, good saints, how I feared to set my foot upon a dead man's cheek, each step, or feel the spear I thrust to seek for hollows tangled in his hair or beard. It may have been a water rat I speared, but ugh, it sounded like a baby's shriek. 22. Glad was I when I reached the other bank. Now for a better country. Vain presage. Who were the strugglers? What war did they wage? Whose savage trample thus could pad the dank soil to a plash? Toads in a poisoned tank, or wild cats in a red-hot iron cage? 23. The fight must so have seemed in that fell cirque. What penned them there, with all the plain to choose? No footprint leading to that horrid muse, none out of it. Mad brewage set to work their brains, no doubt, like galley slaves the Turk pits for his pastime, Christians against Jews. 24. And more than that, a furlong on, why, there! What bad use was that engine for, that wheel, or brake, not wheel, that harrow fit to reel men's bodies out like silk? With all the air of Tophet's tool on earth left unaware, or brought to sharpen its rusty teeth of steel. 25. Then came a bit of stubbed ground, once a wood, next a marsh, it would seem, and now mere earth, desperate and done with. So a fool finds mirth, makes a thing and then mars it, till his mood changes and off he goes, within a rood. Bog, clay and rubble, sand and stark black dearth. 26. Now blotches rankling, colored gay and grim, now patches where some leanness of the soils broke into moss or substances like boils. Then came some palsied oak, a cleft in him like a distorted mouth that splits its rim, gaping at death, and dies while it recoils. 27. And just as far as ever from the end. Not in the distance but the evening, not to point my footstep further. At the thought, a great black bird, Apollyon's bosom friend, sailed past, not best his wide-winged dragon penned that brushed my cap, perchance the guide I sought. 28. For looking up, aware I somehow grew, spite of the dusk, the plain had given place all round to mountains, with such name to grace mere ugly heights and heaps now stolen in view. How thus they had surprised me, salve at you! How to get from them was no clearer case. 29. Yet half I seemed to recognize some trick of mischief happened to me, God knows when. In a bad dream, perhaps. Here ended, then progress this way, when, in the very nick of giving up one time more, came a click as when a trap shuts, you're inside the den. 30. Burningly, it came on me all at once. This was the place. Those two hills on the right, crouched like two bulls locked horn in horn in fight. While to the left, a tall scalped mountain, dunce, dotard, a-dozing at the very nonce after a life spent training for the sight. 31. What in the midst lay but the tower itself? The round, squat turret, blind as the fool's heart, built of brown stone, without a counterpart in the whole world. The tempest's mocking elf points to the shipman, thus the unseen shelf he strikes on, only when the timbers start. 32. Not see? Because of night, perhaps? Why, day came back again for that. Before it left, the dying sunset kindled through a cleft. The hills, like giants at a hunting, lay chin upon hand to see the game at bay. Now stab and end the creature to the heft. 33. Not here? When noise was everywhere. It tolled, increasing like a bell, names in my ears of all the lost adventurers, my peers. How such a one was strong, and such was bold, and such was fortunate, yet each of old lost. Lost. One moment knelled the woe of years. 34. There they stood, ranged along the hillsides, met to view the last of me, a living frame for one more picture. In a sheet of flame, I saw them, and I knew them all. And yet, dauntless, the slug-horn to my lips I set, and blew. Child Roland, to the dark tower, came.
The Dark Tower 7, The Dark Tower, was written by Stephen King and read by George Guidel. The recording engineer was Erica Weintraub, with editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, technical director. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Ellen Hurst. The Dark Tower 7, The Dark Tower, was produced and directed by Kelly Gilday. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Dark Tower 7, The Dark Tower, is available in hardcover from Scribner. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, Stephen King's The Dark Tower 5, Wolves of the Kala, and The Dark Tower 6, Song of Susanna, read by George Guidel.